Today, I had the chance to sit down and speak with Mike Hogenmiller, a 40-plus year retail veteran, where we talked about what most people miss about successful retail. Mike speaks with such a clarity about the importance of the consumer, prioritization, and the birth of Home Depot's online business back in the early 2000s. Something really unique that we touched on was the importance of the culture that the founders put into place in a really large retailer like Walmart, and how this shows up on the negative side in retailers like Target, who have lost their soul. Finally, we end on a discussion about what aspiring direct-to-consumer leaders should remember as they embark on their own brick-and-mortar retail adventures, either in wholesale environment or in their own stores. If you find conversations like this helpful, make sure you're following the show so you don't miss future episodes. I'm here with Mike Hogenmiller, who has a 40-year-plus career in the home improvement industry as a digital and retail leader. Welcome to the show, Mike.
Thank you, Rick. It's a pleasure to be here.
Obviously, you've been through a number of different enterprises, and I don't know if eras is the right term or phases. How do you frame up your career for our audience?
Individual decades. all with a different focus and almost a different consumer, quite honestly. But yeah, it's been an interesting journey.
How did you get started in this crazy era? And like, what were some of the biggest pivot points you saw? And you even started alluding to it. Like, when did the consumer start to change in your mind?
You know, I got to tell you, I think what's interesting, you know, in the career I've been fortunate enough to participate in is, you know, a viewpoint of wholesale, retail, primarily in brick and mortar in the beginning, at the forefront in 2001 with Depot when we made an acquisition to get us started in what I call the era of piece pick operations and consumer acquisition, you know, kind of where they wanted to interact versus where the retailer was providing them to interact. And then from there into managing relationships with vendors who were supplying us with, you know, $400 to $500 million worth of products. And in a space where over time there were categories that went from 100% brick and mortar environments to almost 100% digital environments. And at the same time, having to navigate, you know, how the consumer was changing. And then of course we all had to navigate the acceleration, you know, in 2020 with COVID.
Right.
And so the ability to experience a consumer back in the late 80s and early 90s who suddenly became very progressive in the mid 2000s and then on into 2019, and with the advent of COVID, the market itself is dramatically different than it was 20 years ago. And I've been fortunate enough to participate in all those changes. And that's driven kind of a viewpoint today that takes everything into consideration within the arc, and where I think we may be turning a corner and missing a significant piece of the puzzle right now.
You know, obviously we talk in the industry, I think, speaks a lot about e-commerce, but you've said that Home Depot never really thought about it as e-commerce, but kind of something different. It's just a clear set of priorities. And we were talking about this before our interview. Could you lay those out for us and
Sure. How
you think about them?
Depot's leadership was interesting, as for whatever reason, there seemed to be somewhat of a little bit of a crystal ball there that over time consumers were going to, you know, reprioritize the way they acquired and managed, you know, their own home improvement needs. And, you know, I alluded earlier to an acquisition that Depot made in 2001 of a what I would call a small wholesale distributor in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, named Your Other Warehouse, that was already doing piece pick distribution in a digital environment. At the time, was called special order, which is interesting enough. So take for example, you know, a wholesaler in New York who needed a specialty item for a job they were doing. It's just, well, to make it up, call it a black toilet, which was less than 2% of the market. And so he would reach out to Your Other Warehouse, and Your Other Warehouse would ship that piece individually to the end user for that job, right? This was in 2001, so this was 20, 25 years ago.
Yeah.
at the time, they had 4,000 business-to-business customers doing that kind of activity. So a faucet here, a garbage disposal there, a toilet here,
got it.
A
bathroom. And to translate this for the youngsters in the audience, piece pick distribution, direct to consumer, that's what we call dropship today. Is that right?
Yeah. And so if you go back to that, that's actually been a part of the environment for technically 30, 35 years, but never the primary driver or never much of a focus. And I think, you know, what was important then, and as part of that acquisition team, learned early on kind of what that business, you know, could look like over time. Amazon was their biggest customer at the time in 2001. So they were doing all the home improvement distribution for Amazon in 2001. And P.S., Amazon was their most profitable customer. So cost was not, you know,
Amazon. So that's an interesting point for its own. That's probably the last time Amazon was a profitable customer of anybody.
That would be correct. So anyway, when Depot, you know, acquired that business and started to kind of understand, they made a critical decision in the mid-2000s, driven by the banking crisis at the time. But our CFO and the leadership at the time said, no more stores. We're not opening any more stores. So that was 20 years ago. And the focal point at that time was, we're going to figure out how to make our existing assets more productive. And that included a significant change in supply chain, because at the time we were buying most of our products in a prepaid environment direct to a store, which wasn't conducive to ever developing your own distribution platform and being any kind of piece pick operation, because you were buying everything there was no leverage, there was no consolidation of freight was happening. So at that point in time, they embarked on this platform to convert everything over to collect, and in the process figured out that we could save hundreds of millions of dollars by leveraging our own freight, you know, into our own transportation contracts. And that became the initial springboard for investing in the digital space and building piece pick distribution across the United States. And now being, you know, I think the last number I heard from the leadership at Depot, they're within a day, you know, one day delivery of 90% of their customer base.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah.
And
fended off Amazon at the same time, by the way. And went 15 years ahead of their primary competitor while they were doing it. So.
Right. No, it's super interesting. And I think your order of priorities, consumers, associates, suppliers, investors, it strikes me that a lot of people, they worship at the altar of data.
Mm-hmm.
Without understanding, is my offer any good?
Yeah, so, you know, here's what's interesting. You could say all day long that the data that Depot was looking at was kind of pointing towards some inevitable change in the market. Mm-hmm. But the reality was, you know, the way Depot looks at the business and the way I've strategized most of my work, both with them and after them, is nothing matters other than what the customer's expectation is and where their value proposition lies in terms of how they acquire goods, right? So, you know, Depot, and I think Craig Menear at the time, who was the CEO, coined the term that, you know, Depot was not interested in e-commerce. Depot was interested in commerce. And commerce was literally providing the consumer the ability to make whatever decision they wanted to make in terms of what they bought, when they bought it, what they paid for it, quite honestly, when it was delivered and how it was delivered. And so Depot became obsessed with creating that environment, not driving the consumer to make a particular decision, which is kind of what happens in today's marketplace, is everybody's trying to force the customer into an experience or dynamic that, quite honestly, the customer doesn't care about.
Right.
Right. And so when Depot said, hey, look, we're always going to put the customer at the front of every decision we make, whether it's operations, marketing, merchandising, it doesn't matter. The customer is always going to be the pivot point of why we do what we do. The associates come second because they're delivering the experience, whether it be in digital or brick and mortar space. The suppliers are actually providing the innovation, and we tend to forget that they're the innovation supplier in the pipeline. And then the investors are actually providing, you know, the economy for us to scale and grow. So they're all important. But in today's environment, the order's been rearranged. And it's been rearranged based on the platform of what folks were working in to their own taste.
Right.
Right. So
yeah, and some ways, and this happens in technology too, more than what you probably care to admit. You have solutions in search of a problem. In which case, you're trying to force fit something to a consumer who is, either isn't shopping, doesn't have that need, doesn't care about your margin goals. They just want what they want.
I just came off of a project with a group in New York where they identified, and hear me out for a minute, because this is kind of the consumer reaction that we forget. And basically, in the commercial shipping environment, there's about a $200 billion procurement platform there. So buying, so we're talking about bulk cargo ships, container ships, ro-ros, which are car carriers. Port to port, they buy supplies, mops, brooms, food, navigation parts, whatever. That's still in a very much an analog environment. So people are still working on spreadsheets and using brokers
to
port. And the brokers are purveying the products, gathering them up from different places, and then ultimately delivering it dockside. And this particular group's vision was to create Amazon of the ocean, right? So instead of you having to prepare a shopping list at every port, that shopping list was already prepared for you through quote-unquote AI. It had already been sourced to the most economic means possible and waiting for you shipside when you arrive. So that meant as a ship captain, you no longer had to go through that process to report. The non-value added cost in that whole environment is about 18 to 22%. So costs that we said could be removed. And in the end, nobody cared. Nobody cared. The environment was so used to the platform that they were operating in that we were 5-10 years ahead of the curve. And they were so obsessed in fuel acquisition and labor that they didn't care about. The rest of the platform didn't matter. And so here we had an idea that somebody formulated off of data and environment, forgot to get the customer.
Well, I feel like we just went through that with COVID, with this sort of like tech-enabled logistics revolution, which ultimately, from my vantage point, there's some people who made out from that, but I don't think it was any kind of grand success, because technology generally is a rounding error to the fixed assets we're talking about.
I laugh when I see the technology out there in terms of getting inventory into a more productive space than it is right now. You know, in my experience, that's been a focal point for large organizations for some time, right? So availability on shelf, you know, you get to, you know, a 92, 93% in stock rate, which is shelf availability versus in the pipeline, right? So there's a ton of ways to look at it, but most big retailers have looked at it quite in depth. But now we got technology going, hey, you know, we can get you another 94, 95%. And I'm like, yeah, nobody cares. And nobody cares because of the investment it takes in inventory to get another point of in stock, you know, across, you know, SKUs that are A to F in velocity, is insane. But we don't talk about that because we're so focused on the data side of the equation, we forget what the reality of the market really is.
Yeah. I mean, it's crazy. And I think it's a good segue into our next topic about transformation and why most transformation fails. I often find, look, most project fails in the setup and the goals and who's asking for it, why they're asking for it, the team they put on it. There are 100 reasons why a project fails, but ultimately solving the wrong problem has got to be at the top of the list somewhere.
Well, it's not only solving the wrong problem, but it's understanding, you know, what the end goal actually is and where does it fit the scheme of things, right? And the scheme of things being, by the way, you know, a customer that has no idea whether you're 90%, 92%, 93%, they could care less, right? You know, their intent is, when I go out to buy something, I just need it available to buy. Is there an expectation that everything everywhere is always going to be available? Of course not. So you take the consumer, you know, expectation and you mold it into a business model and off you go. Instead, we try to create, you know, it's funny, I the LinkedIn post, you know how vocal I am, and I apologize if I'm too vocal, but, you know, CPG right now, it drives me nuts because they're so focused on their own individual brand that they're forgetting that there's a consumer and a retailer involved in the end. I think the latest one I saw was somebody celebrating this Heinz floor sticker in a grocery store in the UK, and I just, you know, framed out with a big frame that says Heinz on everything. It made me want to just, you know, throw that somebody believes that's a great, you know, environment to put a consumer in. But anyway, so somewhere along the way, the data said if we had big signs for Heinz in the store, we sell more Heinz.
If you're anything like the CEOs and ops leaders I talk to, you're tired of the AI hype cycle. You're ready to move past the prototypes and actually use AI in your daily workflow. This is exactly where Avalara is leaning in. They aren't just giving you a chatbot to answer questions. They've built agentic tax and compliance. Here's why that matters. Most AI just assists you like a sidekick. It gives you more homework. Avalara's AI agents actually do the work. We're talking about AI that lives inside your ERP or your Shopify store to automate the entire lifecycle, from tax calculations and cross-border classification to actually filing the returns and resolving jurisdictional notices. It's about moving from data to decisions in seconds. You can query your tax data in natural language and get back expert verified answers, not AI hallucinations. If you want to stop messing around with manual compliance and start scaling, you need to see what they're doing with Avi. Go check out the page they set up just for this show. Get the full breakdown at avalaratax.watsonweekly.com. That's avalaratax.watsonweekly.com. I mean, if you look at culture and the behavior of the org, like get the goal right, get the wrong culture. Talk about the cultural misses that a lot of companies have.
There's no clear value proposition in the environment today. And I would tell you, this is a personal opinion, nothing on the inside, but I even believe that culturally Home Depot has strayed off the path. Mm. And I think it's because we've become so financially focused as a result of the accessibility of all the information that we have today, right? So, hey, this says if I do this, I get one extra, you know, sale across, you know, 35 stores, or I get an extra percentage, you know, tenth of a percentage point in conversion if I implement this data. And then along the way, we forgot that we were still in the relationship business, not only between us and our customer, but between us and those who interact and are dependent in our business, you know, primarily the suppliers. And associates fit in that same model, because I can remember a time when we would walk into a store and everything the associate said was what was important to hear and listen to, and then also interact with consumers and being, you know, and hear and listen to what they had to say. Now you got leaders going into stores, if they even go to a store.
Right.
Another problem.
Yeah, this is something Sam Walton was always huge on, and why he was able to improve more quickly than anyone else, because they had those daily, weekly meetings with all the store managers. He was hearing it directly from the field in real time.
The Walmart, so, I'm very vocal about Target, and I'm vocal about Target because it's a great company with a lot of opportunities that seem to be missing the peg right now. But the difference between Walmart and Target, and quite frankly, Walmart and everybody else, is Walmart has a culture that the founders will not release. And quite honestly, the customers won't allow Walmart to release it either.
I think you're right there.
Right? Target released it 15 years ago, 20 years ago. Mm. A lot of companies release the culture inadvertently, quite honestly, because they lost focus of what the priority should be. And they got so enamored with an environment that was changing at a rapid pace that identifying where the changes were happening and how to address those became more important than listening to the customer. And that's a terrible situation. I can tell you, and you're gonna laugh at this, but I can actually prove the point. The consumers right now are paying between 10 and 15% more than they have to, because we've lost the ability to manage relationships across the procurement platform. And as a result, everybody's building in risk.
Yeah.
So every supplier has X amount of dollars in the left pocket that they don't share. And they don't share because they know the retailer is going to ask for it in the right pocket, and they want to be able to move it from the left pocket to the right pocket and not disrupt their ability to make money. That's a problem. And that continues to manifest itself in today's market over and over again.
I think Target's a good discussion because it's somewhat of a fall from grace. Definitely kind of the style, the feel, the merch. Target's always had great merchandisers and the great merchandising capability, as evidenced by the fact that they have many billion-dollar businesses across, you know, a number of different categories. But it feels to me like the store experience is what they forgot about. It's not just the merch. It's the feeling that the customer has shopping with you. And I felt like 10 years ago, Target prioritized online and these, you know, excuse my French, like goddamn pickers that were in the way of the customer shopping, you know? And I don't think it was a bad idea to go to same day and fulfill from store. I think those are all great, as long as it doesn't interfere with number one, which is the consumer.
Well, there's two things. I mean, you know, it's funny, they tried to bring Target back, which, you know, is interesting in itself. But their merchandising group today is so absorbed around managed brands that they forget there's an environment that those managed brands have to live in, right? That the consumer accepts as part of the value proposition within the company. You know, when we started seeing empty end caps and we started seeing runs empty for days and days and days and weeks and weeks, and you know, a grocery, I mean, don't even get me started on grocery. They have no strategy around that entire section of the store, right? Right? So they're struggling to figure out what to do other than to make these periodic announcements that we're reducing prices on thousands of SKUs, and the customer's going, well, it's not the problem.
Yeah.
The problem's not, you know, you're never going to be competitive with Walmart. We know that. But you have an environment that we used to love to shop in, that quality's gone to hell in a lot of the categories. Grocery has no strategy. There's operational inefficiencies that they keep struggling to try to correct. And so there's no focal point for where they're going to go. And then this latest change in their management, quite frankly, wasn't even a change. It's like taking a, you know.
Right, totally. They just shuffled the deck chairs around.
You take a deck of cards and you shuffle it and think the cards are going to be different when you turn them over. They're just,
you know, succession,
they're just in a different order.
Succession planning is such a bugbear for me because I won't say it's easy to get right, but it's like an own goal in hockey, or you know what I mean? It's something you have direct control over is succession planning. It's something you can see years out, as witnessed by what John Furner just did, picked his own successor before he started the role, you know?
Well, I agree with you 100%. And, you know, and that goes back to the whole conversation about Walmart. The Walton family will always be involved. End of story. Right. And because that is, you know, the intent of that organization to never lose sight of what Sam Walton's vision was. Right.
Right.
And so, you know, I sit there and I look at Target and I go, I don't understand your vision. I get these bits and pieces of stuff that you throw out there that all seem to be investor related. Right. Like, how do we appease the next stock price instead of trying to figure out how to get consumers back into the fold again? The other one I would tell you to watch, and I tell you this because I listened to their Q3 earnings calls, is Sprouts.
Mm. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so pay attention to that company. I'll tell you why. You know, first of all, 450 store chain, double digit growth, sitting on an organic and wellness platform, still promotional in nature, small format. Okay. And so I listened to their Q3 call and they start talking about consumer challenges, which is, you know, why would that come up, you know, in that particular call? Well, it's because their comps went from double digits to 5.9 suddenly and we're in a one quarter change, right? And the conversation becomes how many stores are going to open, the innovation center, that portion of their store, and why that, you know, became kind of the brand vision, you know, for their company. But then I noticed, you know, one thing. And on the earnings call, there were three people present. There was the CEO, the CFO, and the COO. There was no merchant. So then I started kind of paying attention. I'm okay, well, wait a minute. You know, who puts an earnings call out and doesn't have merchandising, you know, represented in the process? And then I started going back and kind of digging into the things that Sinclair was saying, you know, in some of his public interviews. And I'm like, this could be an interesting 12 months, because his platform is, he thinks they can get to 1400 stores, but at their level of operation and the investments it would take to do that, it'd take you 25 years to get to that
right
that number. And a lot of things change, you know, every year.
Yeah.
right?
So
if your vision is store count, what are you doing in between to make sure that your existing assets are performing? So I think Q4 could be, I would just say when the earnings come out in Q4, take a look at it and tell me what you see. I think they're going to be a little bit of a struggle bus. And I think that's because they're struggling to keep the value proposition alive.
Yeah, I think scaling a premium consumer is not, first of all, scale and premium don't always go together. And so there's your first problem. It tends to be more specialty. And so specialty is hard to scale unless there's sort of mass component to it.
Well, it's not only that, Rick, but they have a little bit of the same syndrome that Target does. And outside of meat and produce, which is kind of where their distribution is focused, they don't buy with confidence. And so even within that innovation space in the center of the store, they might buy into something new, which has kind of been their forte, is new and organic and wellness, but they only buy, you know, they buy a couple of pieces, or it's a, you know, it's a small 2-foot display. It's, you know, it's trying to, so I don't know if the brand on the front of the building is the driver here, or if it's that innovation space in the middle. And then Target, you know, as well as I do, I mean, they're more apt to look like, you know, Macy's in Magnolia Home, for example, in the space dedication they do to present that product. And then you go in and they got one or two of everything, and you go, well, where's the confidence in the product if you're not buying in any kind of, you know, is supporting, you know, the ceiling, right? Versus playing in the basement all the time, which is what I call it, right?
Right.
So,
yeah.
Anyway.
And it strikes me that Sprouts versus somebody like a Trader Joe's, it feels like there's a little bit of a tale of two chains too.
Well, think about it. So there's Sprouts, you know, in that small format. There's Trader Joe's, and it's, although Sprouts is bigger than those, but there's Aldi lying in there. There's Lidl lying in there. You know, you start looking at the grocery, you know, and the chain I point to constantly is HEB, because even though they're regional in nature, they're a 400 to 500 store chain that anyone who shops there will not shop anywhere else, no matter what. They just
a powerhouse in Texas.
Yeah, and so, you know, you look at it, go Costco has a value proposition that won't change, right? Amazon's won't change. There's all about instantaneous,
right?
Joy in getting something in the next 15 minutes, but you got Costco. You got a number of companies out there that have value propositions that just are not going to change.
Yeah,
and then you got those that are still trying to find it, which is where things get scary, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think it's interesting. I think this is a good place to start to recap the interview a little bit. I mean, there are a lot of direct consumer leaders, and, you know, the newer generation that's coming up. A lot of people grew up with direct to consumer, and now they're going the other direction. They're thinking about adding wholesale, they're thinking about adding stores. What advice would you give some of these leaders as they navigate their journey into stores, either own stores or wholesale?
Let's talk about Wayfair for a second, and then I'll give you your answer, okay? An e-commerce space does not make a brick-and-mortar space. Mm. And I say that because the talent that it takes to define space, with operate within four walls with a finite SKU count, right? Because it's no longer infinite.
Yeah, yeah.
Manage the finances that go along with that in order to build actual categories that within the category, there's structural intent. And that means the category has a specific role within the four walls, whether it be transactional, whether it be market, you know, basket completer, whether it be project completer. And so in the e-commerce world, that didn't exist. The e-commerce world is all about SKU count, right? It's how to add enough SKUs. Even at Depot, there was a point in time, Rick, where the entire goal for e-commerce was to add every SKU we could find. Just add every single one that we could find. That was the intent.
And that's what Walmart's doing right now. They just added musical instruments last month.
Go on Depot's site. You'll be shocked at what you find on their site. I mean, go in there and you can shop toys today if you want to. But that's not... Yeah, you know, but now
intentionality is what I'm getting for you about the stores.
Exactly. And so, you know, I laugh because Amazon's opening a store, I think, in Chicago, a couple hundred thousand square feet. Everybody's going, oh, Walmart, watch out. And I'm like, oh, yeah, this is going to be another.
Maybe the fifth time's a charm.
Yeah, holy crap. You know, they've owned Whole Foods for 10 years, and they still got the same market share they had 10 years ago. But anyway.
Yeah, you just know when they didn't get it, that concept back in the day. They opened these 4-star stores. I'm like,
the regurgitation of brick and mortar that Wayfair is putting in the market right now drives me insane. And it's insane because I know they don't have a same building that platform. It's just out there.
Yeah.
So, anyway.
Yeah.
And there's a long-term strategy, by the way.
Well, this has been a fantastic conversation, Mike. I really appreciate your pearls of wisdom. And I know my audience will be, if they want to read more from you, where can they go to find it?
You won't find anything except on LinkedIn. That's the only environment that I operate in. If they're interested in more detail around the way I look at the market, there's a couple of books out there on Amazon that are fairly inexpensive, that are short reads, that are around kind of what it takes to make a merchant, a successful. And I think that's always going to be the driving piece of retail, whether you're digital or brick and mortar.
Right.
And then there's another one on the supplier side that says why they're struggling today.
Yeah.
So, but otherwise, LinkedIn. I'm the critic out there that irritates most people. So
see how it goes. That's awesome. Well, I appreciate your time being so generous and looking forward to talking again soon.
No, thanks, Rick. I appreciate it. It was fun.